believe I've already finished slide 6, but we were talking about energy-carrying molecules, including NAD, which is a nucleotide. And we can, in slide 7, finally get a look at the molecule and see why it's called nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. Remember what it means to be a nucleotide. You have to have three components to be a nucleotide, right? A pentose sugar, a nitrogenous base, and a phosphate. So this right here is one nucleotide. It happens to be have adenine as the nitrogenous base. This is another nucleotide. It just doesn't have one of the four nitrogenous bases that RNA uses or that DNA uses. It's still a nitrogenous base, though. This is nicotinamide. So when you hook these two together through their phosphates, you have a dinucleotide based on one that has adenine and one that has nicotinamide. Nicotinamide, adenine, dinucleotide. That explains the name, but the reason that the nicotinamide nitrogenous base is highlighted in white is because that's really the business end of the molecule in terms of its function as an energy-carrying molecule. And remember that the energy that it's carrying is in the form of electrons and protons from the fuel. Electrons and protons came from the fuel because the fuel gets dehydrogenated. And a hydrogen atom that's taken away from the fuel contains an electron and a proton. We talked about that last time. So you can see here that this on the left is the oxidized version, the oxidized form of NAD, which is NAD plus in symbols. And when you take two hydrogen atoms from the fuel, as we said before, that really means that you have two electrons, two protons to work with. The nicotinamide part of NAD plus can receive both electrons and one proton. That forms NADH. And then you still have another proton in solution that's left over. But that's why we use as a symbol for the reduced form of this coenzyme, NADH and H+. Everything that's on the left is still on the right. They just didn't repeat all the rest of the molecule because, like I said, it's the important part is the nicotinamide. You can see right here that this hydrogen isn't present in the oxidized form. That hydrogen came from the fuel. All right, slide 8. We have another combustion reaction here, except the fuel here is hydrogen. Well, the hydrogens that we get from the fuel is also hydrogen, of course, but just hydrogen gas itself can be used as a fuel. And burning that, combusting it, means reacting with oxygen. And that will release a lot of energy. That's why the Hindenburg blew up. It was using hydrogen to keep that blimp up. But anyway, the vertical change here represents delta G because this is a graph of G. Much higher G before the reaction occurs, much lower G afterwards, meaning this is what kind of reaction? It's exergonic and spontaneous, by the way. That's true for any fuels, right? That's why we call them fuels. Fuels are things that you can burn for the purpose of releasing energy. So their combustion reactions are exergonic. And you can, you know, put flame to hydrogen in the presence of oxygen, like if you used a hydrogen-powered vehicle, and that would release a lot of energy all at once in one step. But as we've talked about before, we don't do that with our fuels, right? Because that would be too much release at once. It would kill the cell. It wouldn't give the cell opportunity to usefully use that released energy. It would just be heat. But remember that delta G depends only on the G at the beginning and the G at the end. And nothing, it doesn't depend at all on how you get there. So you don't have to do this all in one step. You can also use hydrogen that came from glucose, for instance, in the presence of oxygen to release that energy stepwise. That's what's happening on the right, and that's what happens in cells. It's the same release of G. It's the same delta G because it's the same beginning and ending point. But instead of doing it in one reaction, we do it in many steps. And those steps include a process called electron transport, which is part of cellular respiration. That's the part that is very analogous to a multi-step hydroelectric power plant that we looked at before. That's what these wheels are representing. Each time the electron gets passed along what are called electron transport chains, a little bit of the G is released. A little bit of free energy is released in manageable parcels. You lose a little heat always, of course. You waste heat. That's nothing you can do about that. But by doing it in steps, some of that energy, a lot of that energy, can be captured to put to use building ATP molecules. You end up the same place, though. Water is produced because oxygen gets reduced. That's true for combustion in general, right? The fuel gets oxidized. Oxygen gets reduced. And by receiving the electrons and the protons, oxygen is not only being reduced, it's getting hydrogenated, which is why it turns into water. We produce water metabolically using the oxygen that we breathe and hydrogens from the food we eat. Well, that brings us to 9, and now we can finally get to the particulars of the overall process. Is that a question?
Yeah, I was wondering why it was 1/2 O2 and not just O.
Oh, that's just to make the stoichiometry correct. It is equivalent to O. It's just saying that what we take in oxygen as is not atomic oxygen, it's molecular oxygen. But that's good that you noticed that. Slide 9 is an overview of the entire process, which once again is the complete oxidation of glucose. That's what we're looking at. And there's kind of a hierarchy involved here, which can get confusing because the overall process, complete oxidation of glucose, has many steps, but two major parts, which are glycolysis, which always happens first, and then cellular respiration. But what I mean by the hierarchy is that it doesn't stop there. Each of these two subparts of the overall process can be broken down into further steps. Glycolysis, just by itself, is a 10-step pathway. Now, you don't see the 10 steps here, but these multiple arrows indicate that this is not just one reaction. It's 10 reactions, actually. And glycolysis happens out in the cytosol, the liquid component of the cytoplasm, the solution that's outside of all the organelles but still inside the cell. That's what this ecru background here represents. All right? Glycolysis does not happen in the mitochondria. It happens in the cytosol. And that 10-step process is called glycolysis because it splits sugar. Glyco means sugar. Lysis is splitting. Remember last time I said that to completely efficiently use fuels like glucose, what we have to do is entirely dismantle the carbon skeleton and entirely pick it free of hydrogens. We have to completely dehydrogenate it and completely dismantle the carbon skeleton. Why did I say that? There was a reason I was saying this. I was leading to something. Anyway, glycolysis only partially accomplishes that. Oh, yeah, this is why. Glycolysis starts the breakdown of the fuel, but it doesn't completely dismantle the carbon skeleton. Glycolysis is a hexose, right? So it's a single molecule containing 6 carbons. After the 10 steps of glycolysis, what you have is pyruvate, which is a 3-carbon compound. So glycolysis takes 1 6-carbon glucose and stepwise converts it into 2 3-carbon pyruvate molecules. That's partial dismantling, not complete dismantling, right? Also, not all the hydrogens get picked off. So this is another way of saying that the output, the final product of glycolysis, which is pyruvate, is not entirely spent fuel. It is still valuable fuel. It's only partially spent. Partially spent means that we've extracted some of the energy out of it, so pyruvate does not have as much energy in it as glucose did originally. But if you stop at just glycolysis, which some cells have to in certain conditions, then you don't get a maximum ATP yield because you don't get all of the usable energy out of that original glucose. Glycolysis, though, does yield some ATP. There are inputs and outputs to glycolysis. The inputs are glucose itself, which is the fuel. You also have to input oxidized NAD, which is NAD plus, right? Glycolysis relies on there being empty taxis to pick up the hydrogens that get picked off during glycolysis. Those hydrogens have to go somewhere, so you have to input NAD plus. Now this white thing is an arrow coming out, so that's an output. NAD plus would be coming in. So those are two inputs, NAD plus and glucose. You also input ADP, which is also kind of partially spent, right? The goal of this whole process is ATP. ADP also carries energy, just not as much, right? And we can convert ADP into ATP, which is like making an energy deposit. So ADP comes in, fuel, glucose, comes in, and NAD plus comes in. The outputs are pyruvate, which is partially spent fuel, NADH, which is reduced coenzyme, carrying a lot of energy because it picked up the hydrogens from the fuel, some of the hydrogens, and ATP, because some of the energy released by splitting this sugar into 2 smaller sugars provides some energy to phosphorylate an ADP molecule into an ATP molecule. All right, so that's partial energy extraction. We get some of the energy that's extracted is just wasted as heat. I keep saying this, but there's no way around that. Second law. Some of the energy gets captured in the form of ATP, which is the goal. So that ATP is ready to go. Doesn't require any further processing. And a lot of the energy gets captured, more than what is in ATP, gets captured in the form of the reduced coenzyme, NADH. Never lose track of the fact that a reduced coenzyme is a valuable thing. It is carrying energy that was in the fuel and that will eventually be put into ATP, but right now it's riding in the taxi. Okay, NADH, that's another output. And of course, there's also still a lot of energy in pyruvate itself because that's only partially spent fuel. It's valuable stuff. So this is, since pyruvate is valuable fuel still, that's why glycolysis can't be the only thing you do if you're going to maximize the amount of energy, usable energy extracted. That's why the whole process is called the complete oxidation of glucose. Glycolysis is not the complete oxidation, it's just part of it. And you therefore need a process that will take pyruvate, the partially spent fuel, and complete that dismantling and dehydrogenation of the fuel. That additional process is cellular respiration. And anatomically, cellular respiration occurs in a mitochondrion, which is why you can see the white arrow leading from glycolysis into the mitochondrion. Glycolysis happens in the cytosol. Cellular respiration, which is everything else in the process, occurs in the mitochondria, or a mitochondrion. Okay, so there's 10 steps to glycolysis. We don't see the detail here yet. Glycolysis is part one with 10 steps. Part two of the overall process is cellular respiration, which itself has three parts. And they're not all listed here. The first one is just represented by this white arrow going into the mitochondrion, but the name of the first part of cellular respiration is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. So it should make sense that pyruvate is in the name of the first part, because cellular respiration starts where glycolysis leaves off. And what glycolysis spits out is pyruvate. So think about this phrase, oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. What is decarboxylation? No, not really. Look what's in this word, carboxyl, right? What is dehydrogenation? Say it. Removal of carbon. Right, D means removal. To detoxify means removing toxins. Dehydrogenation is removal of hydrogens from the fuel, for instance, as we said before. Decarboxylation means removing a carboxyl group from something, just like dephosphorylation means removing a phosphate group from something. So that's the name of the first part, and we'll look at that in a second, but that's represented here just by this white arrow. The second part of cellular respiration goes by any of three names: citric acid cycle, or CAC for short, which is the name shown here, but it can also be called the Krebs cycle, eponymously, meaning named after a dead person. That's eponyms are, you see them a lot in biology, but they're not really helpful because they don't tell you anything about the process, right? But anyway, you can call it the Krebs cycle, or you can call it the tricarboxylic acid cycle. Or TCA cycle. They're all interchangeable. They all refer to the same thing, which is part two of cellular respiration. Part three is oxidative phosphorylation, as you can see in the lavender box. But part three, which is already part three of part two, right? Because cellular respiration is part two of the overall process. Oxidative phosphorylation is part three of that. And part three itself has two parts, subparts, which you can see by the colon here. Those processes are called electron transport and chemiosmosis. Together, those make up what is called oxidative phosphorylation. And in terms of the goal, which is to produce ATP using the energy that was originally in glucose, this final step, oxidative phosphorylation, is the big payoff, which is why this balloon around ATP coming out here on the bottom is bigger than the other balloons. The ATP individually are identical. All ATPs are the same. But this just refers to the fact that there's a hell of a lot more ATP produced in this final part than there are earlier on. Now, ATP is produced by glycolysis, as I said. There's no ATP produced by the first part of cellular respiration, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. There is ATP produced by the citric acid cycle, which you see right here. And like I just said, there is also, and mostly, ATP produced by oxidative phosphorylation. The ATPs are indistinguishable, no matter where they're made or by what method. But the ATP that's produced by glycolysis and the citric acid cycle is produced differently compared to how it's produced in oxidative phosphorylation. Oxidative phosphorylation is the name for the method by which this ATP is produced, and we'll look at that in a little bit. The ATP produced in these other previous steps, though, is produced by something that's called substrate-level phosphorylation, which we'll look at first. And as the name implies, that involves a substrate. When you think of these things as taxis, as I like you to, coenzymes, NAD is the main coenzyme type, but there's also a related one called FAD. Notice that they are doing what taxis do. They're picking up hydrogens, electrons and protons from the fuel, and they're driving them to a final destination, which is the third part of cellular respiration. That's where they're dropping them off. That's what these arrows represent. We'll look at the particulars later, but just wanted to indicate that while we're looking at this overall slide. Okay, 10 is a cartoon that describes how substrate-level phosphorylation works, which is how ATP is produced in glycolysis and in the citric acid cycle. Substrate-level phosphorylation involves a substrate, which is something that binds to an enzyme, right? A substrate that is, at first, carrying a phosphate. So a phosphorylated substrate, represented here by this green ball with the phosphate connected to it. So it has the phosphate originally. But being a substrate, it binds to an enzyme, which is the purple thing. And the enzyme specifically is a different kind of enzyme in the two different processes, glycolysis and citric acid cycle. But the scheme is the same, really. What happens is that upon binding to the enzyme, the substrate, which has the phosphate, transfers that phosphate to ADP, which, by the way, is also a substrate. It's binding to the enzyme as well, but it's a different substrate. And by that transfer of phosphate from the substrate to ADP, you transform ADP into ATP and then release the now dephosphorylated substrate as product. All right, so it's just a transfer of phosphate from a substrate to ADP to produce ATP. Now in 11, we can look at the particulars of glycolysis. Actually, we still don't see the detail here, but what we do see in slide 11 is that the overall glycolytic pathway, which is another name for glycolysis, involves two major phases, the so-called energy investment phase and the so-called energy payoff phase. Now, each of these phases is multiple reactions, but it's useful to think of it in these two major phases based on what's happening to energy. Think about what the goal is of using fuel. The goal is to produce ATPs, right? But in the energy investment phase, which comes first, instead of making ATP, you actually have to spend ATP to cause this first part of glycolysis to occur. That's why it's called an energy investment phase. Just like the adage that it takes money to make money, right? You have to invest money in order if you expect to earn interest on it, for instance. Well, here you have to spend energy in the form of ATP, which is exactly the opposite of your goal, but it ends up being worth it because you're going to end up making even more than you spend. Right, so these are per glucose values here. For each glucose molecule, 2 ATP get spent in the early process, this investment phase. But then that allows the rest to happen. You wouldn't be able to go straight to the payoff phase. You have to get through the investment phase for it to happen chemically. And once you've invested those 2 ATP per glucose, then you can see that 4 ATP per glucose are produced. And that's why it's worth it, because you end up netting yourself on the bottom here 2 ATP, right? 4 minus 2. And that is the goal, ATP. So that's the ATP that I said is already ready to go. It doesn't need any further processing. But that's only part of the energy payoff. Because in the energy payoff phase, you also have reduction of NAD plus into NADH and H plus. That's even more energy than the ATPs produced. Because a reduced NAD, in other words, an NADH and H plus, contains more usable energy than ATP. It contains enough energy to eventually, once they get dropped off, produce multiple ATP molecules. And so this two NADHs is actually more energy than these four ATP. Valuable stuff, which is why the taxis are eventually going to their destination and dropping the energy in the form of those electrons and protons off to that final process of cellular respiration. But here we're in glycolysis. Okay, so that's the energy output, ATP and NADH and H+. But the fuel output, because we've only partially spent the fuel, is two pyruvate molecules. All right? Now keep this in mind. You start with one glucose, but you end with two pyruvates. So everything that happens in in cellular respiration, which is going to start where this ends, happens twice per glucose because you have two separate pyruvates from the one glucose that you started with. You see what I'm saying there? One glucose splits into two pyruvates, and each of them independently go through cellular respiration. So when we look at cellular respiration, you have to, per glucose-wise, multiply everything by two. All right, 12. Now we can see individual reactions, but this is only half of glycolysis. This is the so-called energy investment phase. And on the left-hand side, you can see the individual reactions. And you shouldn't be surprised at this point to notice that each individual step in the pathway requires its own specific enzyme. These are enzyme names. I don't expect you to memorize these intermediates. You would have to do that in a biochemistry course, but not in this one. That's not the main point, though. The main point here, being the energy investment phase, is that ATP gets spent at two of these steps. Now, you start with glucose, of course. That gets converted into glucose-6-phosphate. That's just the name for a phosphorylated glucose, a glucose that has a phosphate stuck onto it at the sixth carbon, glucose-6-phosphate. Where did the phosphate come from? ATP. That's why ATP was spent. It gets dephosphorylated into ADP, and the phosphate gets stuck onto glucose to produce this phosphorylated sugar, which is a more energetic sugar than glucose itself. Okay, then you just keep changing the atoms without adding or subtracting any of them. In other words, you isomerize these things. You turn them into isomers. Isomers, remember, have exactly the same chemical formula. So glucose-6-phosphate is a 6-carbon compound, just like glucose is. Fructose-6-phosphate is also a 6-carbon compound. But it's a different arrangement of the carbons compared to glucose-6-phosphate. What I'm trying to point out here is that we haven't split anything apart yet. It's still a 6-carbon fuel. And in fact, it is, well, you add another phosphate here in this step, that's the other ATP that gets spent per glucose, to make a doubly phosphorylated compound, fructose-1,6-bisphosphate, the bis means two. And that's still not broken down, right? You still have a 6-carbon compound. But then you get to this fork in the road, and that's where the splitting or the lysis actually occurs of glycolysis. That's where a 6-carbon compound becomes to 3-carbon compounds. But it's a fork in the road because when fructose-1,6-bisphosphate gets split, there are two possible compounds that can result. Either glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, which is lovingly called G3P, or dihydroxyacetone phosphate. And the cell doesn't know which one is going to happen because they're equally likely, because they're basically at the same energy level. The problem here is kind of a problem, not too big a problem, is that only G3P and not dihydroxyacetone phosphate can proceed to the through the rest of glycolysis. That's why you have a little arrow on the bottom here going to the rest, to the next slide, which is the rest of glycolysis, but not here. And so it would be a problem if it weren't for the fact that dihydroxyacetone phosphate and glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate are isomers of each other, and therefore one can be turned into the other easily. That's what these side arrows indicate. So if, by chance, dihydroxyacetone phosphate is produced instead of glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, it's not the end of the line, because you simply have to then transform dihydroxyacetone phosphate into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate using an enzyme that's called isomerase, because it turns one isomer into the other. So the bottom line is, even though these both can happen, it's all going to end up being G3P. And on a per glucose basis, that means two G3Ps, because these are three carbon compounds, all right? That is the end. I should be pointing to the much bigger version over here. But anyway, that is the end of the energy investment phase, but it's only halfway through glycolysis. The next slide shows you the energy payoff phase, slide 13. So the arrow coming down from above is the G3P that's produced by the previous slide. And that gets turned into other three carbon compounds along the way, so there's no more splitting apart of the carbon skeleton. But notice that the payoff comes in the form of reducing NAD plus into NADH there, and then in these two steps, phosphorylating ADP into ATP. The reason there's a 2 in front of these is because per glucose, this happens twice, since there are two G3Ps produced. All right, you understand what I mean by this multiplying by 2? Is that a no? Per glucose. It's not that two NAD are coming into this specific reaction. It's that this reaction is happening once for one of the G3Ps and another time for the other G3P. So in terms of per glucose, it's two NADs that get reduced and four ATPs or ADPs that get phosphorylated. Okay? And you spent 2 to get there, so you earn 2 ATPs and you earn 2 NADHs. And what's left after all of this, fuel-wise, is pyruvate. Still a 3-carbon useful fuel. It is a useful fuel because it still has a carbon skeleton that can be dismantled, and it still has hydrogens that can be taken off. That is the end of glycolysis. And if a cell is capable, it will certainly want to continue the process and go on to cellular respiration, because cellular respiration will use pyruvate as a fuel and get the rest of the usable energy out of it, producing a lot more ATP. Therefore, let's go to slide 14 and look at the particulars of cellular respiration. What? You sure?
Yeah.
Since glycolysis happens in the cytosol, as I said, and cellular respiration occurs in the mitochondrion, it makes sense that part of the first stage of cellular respiration, which is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, that's what we're looking at here, involves transport of pyruvate from the cytosol into the mitochondrion. That's what the white arrow indicates. And for some reason, they thought it was a good idea to use several different oranges and yellows, but this kind of intermediate orange that happens twice here should remind you of what I've already told you, namely that a mitochondrion is a doubly membrane-bounded organelle, right? So to get pyruvate into the full interior, which is called the matrix, it has to go through the outer membrane, through the intermembrane space, and through the inner membrane to get into the mitochondrial matrix, which is where cellular respiration occurs. In that process of coming in, well, let's look at pyruvate first, before it gets transported in. Pyruvate, which is what glycolysis spits out, is a three-carbon compound. You can see this structural formula right here. Now, at physiological pHs, what would have been an OH gets deprotonated. It loses the proton. That's why it's an O negative, not an OH. But if you imagine this to be an OH, what is this functional group that we're looking at? In whatever color that is. It's a carboxyl group, exactly. And remember that we're looking at the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. So this highlighted part, which is the carboxyl group, is going to be removed. That's what decarboxylation is. These other two carbons are going to remain in what's left of the fuel after you decarboxylate pyruvate. But coming in is part of it. Decarboxylation is shown by CO2 coming off. When you decarboxylate this, you have a carbon and two oxygens. That's carbon dioxide. You should always think of, in terms of this chapter, carbon dioxide being completely spent fuel. Worthless as far as getting energy out of it is concerned. Which is why when the cells are continuously producing CO2 by going through this process, the CO2 accumulates, diffuses into the blood, gets transported to the lungs, diffuses into the air inside the lungs, and then gets exhaled because it's waste. We can't get any more energy out of it. So that is completely spent fuel, but or that particular CO2 is. But there is still fuel left even after you take another one of the three carbons off. What you have over here is, ignore this part at the top, just this, these two magenta C's and their related atoms, is an acetyl group. Okay, that is what's remaining of the fuel at this point, after this first part of cellular respiration. Now this part in salmon, above it, the CoA with the S connected to it, CoA stands for coenzyme A. This is another example of a coenzyme. We've already talked about NAD being a coenzyme. Coenzymes in general carry things from one place to another, helping out an enzyme. Well, coenzyme A by itself is just this salmon-colored thing. And that would be the empty taxi, in a sense. But its job is to pick up what remains of the fuel, which is this acetyl group, after the carbon dioxide has been removed as decarboxylation of pyruvate. This is not pyruvate anymore. It's a two-carbon compound, acetyl, which is the passenger. It gets picked up by coenzyme A, and therefore that full taxi with the acetyl in it is called acetyl coenzyme A. That's the end of this first part, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. But the important thing that we didn't mention here is that even though there's no ATP produced in this step, and ATP is the goal, there's something even more valuable because in this process, NAD+, the oxidized coenzyme, gets reduced into NADH and H+. And that's carrying even more energy than ATP does. So that's another source of reduced coenzyme. We already had some reduced coenzyme produced in glycolysis earlier, right? Now we're producing even more. We're able to do this because breaking the pyruvate down into acetyl releases energy. Some of that energy is stored in the form of reduced coenzyme. But coenzyme A picks up acetyl, and you have acetyl coenzyme A now riding to the second part of cellular respiration, which is what? The citric acid cycle. So I probably have a slide coming up that shows that, which I do. Actually, slide 15 shows both first and second parts of cellular respiration. So this is not just the citric acid cycle. The stuff happening above is what we just looked at. That is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. The other non-carbon atoms are not shown just for simplicity. So pyruvate is just shown as a three-carbon string of beads. The decarboxylation removes one of those carbons. That's completely spent fuel, waste. NAD plus gets reduced into NADH, and coenzyme A picks up the two carbons that are left, the two carbon compound, acetyl, making acetyl coenzyme A. And the job of that taxi is to drive it to the citric acid cycle and drop off just the acetyl. The coenzyme A does not enter the cycle. It just drops off the acetyl into the cycle. All right, so these two carbons that are what remain of the fuel enter the citric acid cycle. Now, the citric acid cycle is called a cycle because it's a pathway, several different individual reactions end to end, but what makes it a cycle is that the final reaction then leads to another round of the initial reaction. That can only continue to happen, though, if you continue adding acetyl, because along the way, things get removed. You can't continue something happening by only removing it, right? You have to remove and add at the same time if you're or at the same rates if you're going to allow it to continue to happen. Now, the particulars of the citric acid cycle aren't shown in this slide, but the important inputs and outputs are shown. The input, fuel-wise, is the acetyl that gets dropped off by coenzyme A. The outputs, as far as fuel are concerned, are more carbon dioxide molecules, which is not fuel at all. It's completely spent fuel. And remember, this is happening twice for each glucose, because you started with one glucose. By the time you get to the citric acid cycle, it's happening twice because you have two acetyls. But each acetyl has two carbons in it. Those two carbons get split apart in the form of two CO2s. And therefore, you have four CO2s overall, because you have two CO2s from one acetyl and two CO2s from the other acetyl. That's four CO2s for the citric acid cycle, plus the two that you already took off of the two pyruvates, for a total of six. Do you see what I'm saying here? Six carbon dioxides are what you have by the end of the citric acid cycle, which means, in terms of fuel, you have none left. The fuel has been completely dismantled into six one-carbon carbon dioxide molecules that don't have any hydrogen on them. That's why it's worthless as fuel. This is another way of saying that the citric acid cycle functions to complete the breakdown of the fuel. You have no more fuel left. Now, in that process, in the process of the citric acid cycle, that is, you not only break it down, but at certain steps, you gain some more energy, usable energy that was in the fuel. There are NADHs that get produced, in other words, NAD pluses that get reduced into NADHs, and there's also a different coenzyme that we haven't talked about yet, which is very similar to NAD, but uses a different nitrogenous base instead of nicotinamide, and that is FAD. The F stands for flavin. So it's flavin adenine dinucleotide. This is also a taxi, but it's kind of like a competing company's taxi. It's a taxi from a different fleet. Does the same job, though. But remember what's true about the two forms of NAD. The oxidized form is what? No. NAD plus. There is no NADH plus. It's NAD plus is the empty taxi. And that's why it takes one electron just to make it NAD, and then another electron and proton to make it NADH, and then you have a leftover proton. We've talked about that before, right? Well, the oxidized or empty version of flavonadenine dinucleotide is FAD, not FAD+. And therefore, it can take all four particles, both electrons and both protons, in other words, two entire hydrogen atoms. And that's why the reduced form of FAD is FADH2, and there is no leftover proton. Is that clear? But this is also carrying a lot of energy, just like NADH and H+ is. And that's produced in the citric acid cycle as well. But you also, once again, produce some ATP. Made ATP by substrate-level phosphorylation in glycolysis. You're making more ATP by substrate-level phosphorylation in the citric acid cycle. And that's the goal, so it's all ready to go, just like it was from glycolysis. But that energy contained in the ATP produced here is not nearly as much as the energy being carried by these reduced taxis, NADH and H+, and FADH2. The fuel is completely spent at this point. You don't have anything usable. But this is not the end of cellular respiration. You're out of fuel entirely, because all you have are six CO2s. Why is it not the end of citric acid? I mean, the end of cellular respiration? Because you have not yet used the useful energy that the taxis are carrying by putting them into the form of ATP, putting that energy into the form of ATP. That's why you need step three, the final part of cellular respiration, so that you can have that final payoff, have the taxis deliver their energetic cargo to that third part, so that energy can be used to produce a lot more ATP. That's what part three of cellular respiration is all about, and that's called oxidative phosphorylation. Before we get there, though, let's take another look, a closer look in slide 16 at the citric acid cycle. This shows you the individual reactions, which I don't want you to memorize, but we can see here that since it's a cycle, it kind of has a start-finish line. The 12 o'clock position right here is a start-finish line, because that's where the acetyl gets dropped off by coenzyme A right here at this point. Okay? Now, keep in mind that what we're trying to do here is dismantle the fuel even further. It's already been partially dismantled, right? The carbon skeleton. Well, here, it looks like we're going in the wrong direction, because exactly the opposite of dismantling a carbon skeleton happens at the start-finish line. At the end, you have an intermediate called oxaloacetate. And you can see the structural formula here. It has four carbons. Coenzyme A drops off acetyl, which is two carbons, has two carbons in it. And that gets added to produce a six-carbon compound called citrate or citric acid. This is why it's called the citric acid cycle, by the way. It's the only difference. They're not really the same thing. Citrate doesn't have that proton because it's been lost to the solution. If this were COOH, it would be called citric acid. But when you put an acid in water, it loses the proton. Anyway, that's why it's called the citric acid cycle. And the point here is, what I mean by going backwards in a sense is that you're now building up even bigger carbon skeleton. You went from four to six. But that's necessary in order for this cycle to turn. And you do end up dismantling what's left of the fuel, because as the cycle turns, two individual CO2s representing the two carbons that are in the acetyl that got added get liberated. And so you really have four CO2s, right? Because you have two acetyls coming in from the two pyruvates that glucose got split into. That's why you have six CO2s overall at this point. You have two from the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, and you have four from the citric acid cycle per glucose. Well, glucose only has six carbons in it. That's why it's totally spent. You've turned it into six worthless CO2s. But along the way, Importantly, you reduce NAD plus into NADH at three different places, and at one place you reduce FAD into FADH2. They're carrying what's left of the energy in the fuel. The fuel is gone. And in one step here at the bottom, you phosphorylate an ADP into ATP to make your goal molecule, ATP. Yeah?
So the oxaloacetate binds with the acetyl coenzyme to make citrate?
That's right. Not acetyl coenzyme, just the acetyl. The coenzyme drops it off and then goes up and picks another passenger up,
right.
Another acetyl.
So are those molecules that are inside the fuel stuck there?
Well, they're being changed into the next one continuously as long as this is operating. I guess that's all I want to say about that right now. Let's go on to 17. Now we're done with the second part of cellular respiration. That leaves only one final part, which really consists of two subparts. The final part is oxidative phosphorylation. That's what was in that purple box in the summary slide. But the two parts of oxidative phosphorylation are electron transport and chemiosmosis. Those are separate processes. What we're really looking at in this slide, 17, is electron transport. Now, this slide serves kind of as an anatomical slide, even though in cartoon form, and as a graph simultaneously. Notice it has a y-axis, which is free energy, or G. Anatomically, you see that these purple things exist as protein complexes. And specifically, where this is, This complex of proteins, which is a complex of complexes, really, because this whole thing is one so-called electron transport chain. Textbooks will often talk about the electron transport chain, which kind of implies that there's only one. There are millions of them. They're all the same for cellular respiration. This is just one of them, but there are many, many copies of this, okay? Just even in one mitochondrion. But this is one electron transport chain, and it's made up of four major protein complexes, which get Roman numerals, 1, 2, 3, and 4, IV should have been. So that's what I meant by a complex of complexes. And an electron transport chain is called that because electrons get transported along that chain from one member of the chain to the next. Now, I usually use a bucket brigade as a kind of an analogy, but it's an old-fashioned example. You know what I mean by a bucket brigade, though? If you live out in the middle of nowhere and there's no fire department that can come by, and the barn is on fire, and your only source of water to put the fire out is in a well that's not right by the barn, the neighbors come by, and instead of running back and forth and wasting their energy, they'll form a line of people called a bucket brigade. They each stay in place. But they, you know, the one next to the well gets a bucket full of water and passes it to the next person, so on down the line, and eventually the end person dumps it onto the fire. That's a bucket brigade. An electron transport chain is similar, except instead of buckets of water, it's electrons that get passed along the chain from one member of the chain to the next. And these complexes are the members of the chain, these protein complexes. Where these are anatomically, or where each electron transport chain is embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane. Not the outer membrane. Remember the difference between outer and inner membrane? The inner membrane is actually much bigger, right? Why is it much bigger? Because it has folds, which are called what? Cristae, exactly. The reason that inner mitochondrial membrane is folded into Cristae is to make much more membrane surface. That's so that you can house in that membrane many more copies of electron transport chains. More electron transport chains you have, the more they can all be doing their work simultaneously, and therefore the more fuel or the more energy can be processed. There is no more fuel at this point, but there's energy that came from the fuel originally. The more that can be processed, and therefore the more ATP that can be produced. So that's what the Christie are there for. You don't see the membrane here, but this one electron transport chain and millions like it are embedded in that inner membrane, in a mitochondria. Now, when you think of this as a graph, though, that's where the diagonal arrangement comes into play. Because this first complex, notice, is listed at a higher G value, and each one is lower and lower G value. This is how the energy gets released a little bit at a time rather than explosively all at once. But it's an electron transport chain, so electrons get transported from member to other member of the chain. Therefore, chemically speaking, what is happening? How would you describe that if electrons are being transferred?
Ionization.
Not exactly. Yes and no, but what's another word that you could be used that's more pertinent to this chapter?
Reduction
and oxidation. Yes, what's happening in an electron transport chain, the process of electron transport, is a series of redox reactions. Right? The first member, by receiving the electrons, is becoming what in that process? By receiving electrons. Reduced. But it's not going to stay reduced because, just like in the Bucher Brigade, he's not going to hang on to the electrons, he's going to pass them to the next member, which is going to re-oxidize that first member, right? And it's going to reduce the second member, which will become re-oxidized when it passes them on to the third member, and so on. So it's a series of redox reactions when you transfer electrons down the line. And each time an electron gets transferred from one member to the next, the electron ends up a little closer to an atomic nucleus than it was previously. Meaning it goes down in energy level, right? The closer you get to the nucleus, the lower energy level you're at. We talked about the shells. That's why you're going down in G as this thing operates. That's the stepwise release of a little bit of energy at a time. All right. Now, where does the first member, complex 1, get the electrons that it will then pass to member 2? You can cheat and look.
NADH.
Right. This is where the taxis get to their destination. NADH has picked up hydrogens, meaning electrons and protons, from the fuel earlier on in the whole process. You got some full taxis in glycolysis. They're delivering their electrons here. You got some NADs from oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. They're also driving and dropping off here. And you got more NADH in the citric acid cycle. They're driving to this same destination. So NADH, this is just one of them. All the NADHs drop their electrons off at complex 1. What happens to NADH then? It gets oxidized back into NAD+, which means it can go back to glycolysis and the other earlier steps and pick up more hydrogens. And bring them here again, or not again, bring new ones here to continue this process. Does that make sense? FADH2 is also a full taxi, but notice that it's not able to drop its electrons off at complex 1. It has to drop them off at complex 2, which is at a slightly lower G value. which means FADH2, in terms of usable energy that can be put toward producing ATP, is not quite as valuable as NADH, which is nice that NADH is the majority of the coenzymes that the cell uses. All right? So that's what delivers electrons. Now, just like in the bucket brigade example, the last member of the chain doesn't hang on to what's delivered to him or her, right? That bucket, he doesn't just hold on to the bucket. If the last member holds on to the bucket, that person can't receive another bucket coming down the line. So that would stop all transport of buckets if the last person didn't throw it onto the fire. In other words, you have to have something taking the transported thing off of the end of the line for the line to continue operating, the chain, just like for the electron transport chain. The reduced coenzymes are delivering electrons. They trickle down through the chain, but if you didn't have anything taking the electrons off at the end of the line, the whole chain would just fill up with electrons, and these taxis would not be able to drop off their passengers. They would remain in reduced form. Well, there is something at the end of the line that takes the electrons off of that final member of the chain. And that something, in a lot of organisms, including us, is oxygen. Now, this process is called, that involves this electron transport chain, is what makes it respiration. That's cellular respiration. Nothing to do with breathing. That's often called respiration. That's really ventilation. Cellular respiration occurs in the cells of the cell, in the cells of the body. But what makes it respiration as a process is this electron transport chain. The thing that is taking the electrons from the final member for most things that are able to undergo respiration is oxygen. Oxygen serves as the final electron acceptor. You have to have a final electron acceptor, or the chain will just fill up with electrons and everything will come to a halt. Okay? Well, in organisms in which oxygen serves as the final electron acceptor, then that specific style of respiration is therefore called aerobic respiration, meaning involving oxygen. There's a smaller number of species that do the same thing, except they use something other than oxygen to receive the electrons. They're still respiring, but that is anaerobic respiration. All right. Most of the respiring organisms, though, use oxygen, which is well suited to the task because oxygen has a high electronegativity. It will gladly take those electrons. And by the way, it doesn't just take the electrons. It also takes protons, which, remember, also were removed from the fuel originally. And even though it's not the same two necessarily, electron and proton get united and stuck onto oxygen. An electron and proton is a hydrogen, and this is why oxygen gets reduced into water, oxygen with hydrogen added. Notice this huge fall in G. That represents how electronegative oxygen is. This final step really is a big change, and oxygen is really well suited to taking these electrons for that reason. As long as there's oxygen available, the chains won't fill up, and therefore the taxis will have somewhere to dump their electrons, and the chains will keep operating. But we haven't gotten to the point of explaining why the operation of the electron chains, transport chains, is valuable. Well, remember, we don't have any fuel left, so the only possibility of extracting more energy out of what was originally in glucose is to use the energy that's being carried by the taxis, NADH and FADH2. Well, they're dumping their electrons off, so they're back to low value. They're back to NAD plus and FAD. And so you don't have any more fuel energy in those anymore. Right? And the electrons, as I just said, are going to lose energy when they get passed along the chain. So by the time you get that to oxygen, you have no more energy left from what was in the fuel. So why would you do this? Well, because of something I haven't mentioned about these four complexes. Well, three of the four. Complex one, the three biggies. Complex one, complex three, and complex four do double duty. They are not only members of the electron transport chain, so they pass electrons along, but they also function as proton pumps. Keep in mind, this whole thing is embedded within the inner mitochondrial membrane, which is exactly where you'd find a pump if you're going to find a pump, right? In a membrane. Now, what are pumps?
They can go against the gradient.
Well, that's what they can do. What are they? Yes, they are active transporters. Transport proteins that work for active transport. And a proton pump, therefore, is a protein embedded in membrane that's able to force protons or hydrogen ions against their gradient through that membrane. Well, what do you know about all pumps? They require an external source of energy. This is not diffusion of protons we're talking about. It's the pumping of protons. In the pumps we've looked at already, often the source of energy was ATP. Right? Like the proton pumps we looked at before, that was powered by ATP. Well, that would be a stupid thing to put in here if you were designing this, right? Because the whole goal is to make ATP. Why would you use ATP to pump protons if the goal is to make ATP? So the source of energy is not ATP. There still has to be a source of energy, though, to force protons against their gradient. And what is the source of that energy? The source of the energy is the free energy that gets lost, or that gets released as electrons trickle down through the chain, right? Every time there's a little bit of G reduction, that's energy being released. And that energy that's released is put into powering these three pumps. But what they pump is not electrons. Electrons power them. What they pump is protons, the other part of the hydrogen atoms from the fuel. And specifically, how they pump them is from the mitochondrial matrix, which is the full interior inside the inner membrane, through that membrane and into the intermembrane space. Okay. Now they'll be able to pump that as long as you continue to have electrons coming down through the chain, releasing their energy to power those pumps. And that's why if you don't have oxygen, then the electrons just fill this chain up, can't be removed, and therefore the pumping stops. But if you still have oxygen and you still have electrons being delivered by the taxis, you still have pumping of protons. At this point, all of the energy from the electrons has been spent as well. So you don't have any fuel, you don't have any coenzymes left, or reduced coenzymes, and you don't have any electron energy left. So why bother to pump the protons? Where is the energy that's still usable that was originally in glucose? I can wait. What did I tell you to always remember about gradients? They are potential energy sources. Right? Gradients are potential energy. They can be put to work. So all of the energy that was originally in glucose that got delivered by the taxis to the electron transport chains and powered the pumping of protons is now in the form of a proton gradient. The proton gradient contains the usable energy that hasn't already been put into ATP, but that was originally in glucose. And there must be a reason why it was worth doing that, right? But that's where the energy is at this point. No more fuel, no more reduced coenzymes, no more high energy electrons. Now you have energy in the form of the proton gradient that got created because of all this. That's electron transport, which is the first part of the last part of cellular respiration. It's the first part of oxidative phosphorylation. Nothing gets phosphorylated in this step, though. This is just electron transport, creating the gradient. Yeah.
So complex 2 is not a proton pump. The only thing that's different about it is it doesn't accept NADH, then only accepts FADH too.
Well, it also accepts electrons from 1. So FAD just can't put them here. It has to put them a little farther down the line. I just said that FADH2 is therefore not quite as valuable as NADH because starting here you skip this pump. And therefore you power only these two. NAD powers all three. And the more protons you pump, the stronger the gradient is, which means that's where the energy is stored. Okay, let's go to 18 then and see the final payoff. The energy that was in the fuel is now in the form of a proton gradient. Well, there's three places where the energy is. Some of it is already in the form of ATP that was produced earlier. Some of it is in the form of heat, which is waste and can't do anything about. And the rest of the energy that was originally in that glucose is now in the form of a proton gradient produced by the electron transport members functioning as proton pumps. And you can see here that the intermembrane space, which is where they got pumped to by the electron transport chains, has therefore a higher proton concentration or hydrogen ion concentration than the mitochondrial matrix, the yellow space on the other side of the membrane. The pumps aren't shown here. The pumps are the electron transport chains. They're not shown here. But they're operating right next door to this thing. Okay? So by the electrons trickling through, that powers the pumping of hydrogen ions from the yellow matrix to the orange intermembrane space. And when you have a gradient, that's a tendency for diffusion, right? But remember, a tendency is not enough. For diffusion to actually occur, you have to have a gradient, which you have, and you have to have a way for that thing to get from A to B. Well, protons would like to get back to the matrix by diffusion, and they don't care how they do it, but protons, even though they're tiny, can't easily get through the phospholipid bilayer that makes up the inner mitochondrial membrane because they are fully charged, and they don't want to be around these hydrophobic tails. So there is only one, well, many copies, but one kind of place where these protons can get back through the membrane, which is through this really complex protein called ATP synthase. So named because it synthesizes ATP. To synthesize, syn means together. To synthesize means to bring things together. The things that are being brought together are ADP and inorganic phosphate, which when they're brought together produce ATP. All right? But this requires a molecular machine, which ATP synthase is. And this is just one of them. There's millions of these as well in the cell. It is the only place, it's kind of like a turnstile, the only place that hydrogen ions can get back through the membrane into the mitochondrial matrix from where they were previously pumped. That's diffusion, right? Because they're going down their gradient if they go back to the matrix. But they would have no tendency to diffuse if it weren't for the fact that you spent some energy earlier to produce the gradient. All right, so you have two major parts to this overall ATP synthase. So it's several proteins complexed together. You have the stator, which remains static. That means it doesn't move. And you have the rotor, which rotates with respect to the stator. Just like in electrical motors, you have a stator and a rotor. Well, this thing is arranged in such a way that the rotor will rotate only if hydrogen ions are diffusing through. Completely analogously to a water wheel, which will not turn on its own. It has to have water falling on it in order to turn it. The hydrogen ions are falling down their gradient by going through this ATP synthase, and that's what spins the rotor. The rotor at the other end, the end that faces the mitochondrial matrix, has this catalytic knob, as it's called, which is several different identical parts. But each part of the knob is an enzyme. An enzyme that is capable of phosphorylating ADP to produce ATP. And notice there is no other substrate involved. So this is not substrate-level phosphorylation. This is oxidative phosphorylation. It's a phosphate on its own, inorganic, that gets attached to the ADP. Each of these little pieces of the knob can do that, but only if it is turning, because turning it deforms the enzyme into a shape that allows that to happen. And that's where the use of the energy that is in the gradient gets put to use. That's where the energy gets put to use, I should say. By deforming these enzymes over and over, by turning the rotor, so that ADP can be phosphorylated into ATP. And as long as this thing continues to spin, that will continue to happen. Sorry I went over. Stop. Don't be afraid to stop.